WJCT in Jacksonville. This is our weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. I'm your host, Vince Kong, and this is Redux. It's March 3rd. We're just days away from the start of the Florida legislative session. From bills impacting how children on the First Coast play and exercise in schools, to being able to have a vodka tonic while sitting at your favorite bistro in some of Jacksonville's historic districts, on this episode of Redux, we're going to bring you what we're keeping an eye on during this session. Then, if you work downtown or just happen to be downtown during lunch, the food truck invasion has arrived. But first, in honor of Women's History Month, we're going to bring you a discussion with a pioneer of gender equality and Jacksonville resident, so please stay tuned.
Some people still don't get podcasts. So all this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they'll love. Now tell us what podcast you recommend with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. Thanks for spreading the word.
In honor of Women's History Month, three-time Olympic gold medalist, civil rights lawyer, and one of the most prominent experts in the country on Title IX, that's the federal law that prohibits gender discrimination within educational programs, including prep and collegiate sports, Nancy Hogshead Makar joined host Melissa Ross this past week on First Coast Connect to discuss the importance of female participation in sports.
We've always known that athletes did better in school. They did better. They were more likely to go into STEM careers. They were more likely to be employed full time. They were healthier. We've always known that. But Bessie Stevenson really was able to look at the data and be able to show that sports caused that, that sports was responsible for all these educational gains and all these staying in the workforce types of gains. And so we know that if a girl plays sports, that she is 20% more likely both to graduate from high school and college.
Nancy also discussed her new role as the CEO of Champion Women. That's a nonprofit based here in Jacksonville that focuses on Title IX issues regarding sexual harassment, abuse, and assault in sports.
So if abuse happens as part of a school, most schools are really well equipped to lay down those bright lines for coaches and teachers and to make sure that there's no romantic or sexual crossing over. When that kid walks across the street, there's none of the same legal protections. And not only that, but most parents sign away their legal rights as part of participating in that program.
Nancy continues the discussion of sexual abuse in youth sports, as well as the future of Title IX under the Trump administration, as well as her recent decision to donate her brain to science, in our exclusive videos, which will be posted to our WJCT Facebook and YouTube pages. Be sure to subscribe and like both of them to find out when they post. First Coast Connect can be heard anytime. Just download the podcast or download our WJCT app. Now, on the eve of the start of the legislative session, which begins March 7th, here are some bills we'll be keeping an eye on. On the education front, everything from mandatory recess to testing schedules are up for debate. As WJCT's Ryan Bank reports, Democratic Representative Tracy Davis and Republican Senator Aaron Bean have laid out their agendas for the session.
Bean is co-sponsoring a bill that would mandate elementary school kids get at least 20 minutes of recess a day. He says the policy is already in place in a handful of Florida school districts, and it's a common-sense way to keep students healthy. He's also supporting a measure to move standardized testing to the very end of the school year, but one PTA member was concerned kids taking advanced placement tests would then be doubling up on exams at year's end. Bean's response?
We will work that out. What we can't have is, and I've got kids in public schools, one right now in high school, but we can't have for the last 2 months of the year watching videos or busy work when we've already taken the test. We will work that out. We'll coordinate that.
Jacksonville teachers also want to push the test back further, but for different reasons. The state uses a student's score to calculate teacher effectiveness, and later tests mean more time for kids to progress. Perhaps the heaviest legislative lift, though, is a bill increasing the use of civil citations for students who run afoul of the law. Democrat Tracy Davis is sponsoring that legislation. She recalled her experience in public schools as a reason why she intends to lead on educational issues like these.
Glad to be in Tallahassee to have a voice for whatever you all need, the concerns that you all have as education.
Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
Here's an issue impacting our beach communities. Right now, it's illegal for Florida towns to regulate the use or sale of plastic bags. That can all change during the upcoming session, something the Jacksonville Beach City Council voted in support of this past week. Jack's Beach officials are backing state legislation to allow beach towns with fewer than 100,000 residents to create a pilot program regulating or banning the use of plastic bags. Local governments that pass such an ordinance would then be required to track its impact on the environment and publish their findings by the year 2020. Last year, a similar state bill died in committees. Also, here's a bill aimed at helping out property owners who suffered damage as a result of the hurricanes last year. Lawmakers will consider giving property tax breaks to First Coast homeowners for property taxes paid on houses destroyed by Hurricane Matthew. Ryan Bank has more.
Palm Coast Republican Senator Travis Hudson wants homeowners with the worst property damage to get relief through their local property appraisers. That would be on top of state and federal emergency funds already available. Hudson's bill would set up a dedicated state fund of no more than $6 million that homeowners could draw from next year. He says his effort is similar to one in 2004 when Florida was rocked by four hurricanes with damage totaling $45 billion.
We had some relief to property owners that, again, were not able to enter their homes for a long extended time. So again, what this bill does is kind of mirrors that and says if you're still not in your home and you haven't been there for months that end, you're not responsible for the 12 months worth of property tax. We're going to give you that relief.
Property owners would fill out a notarized application with supporting documents and send them to their local property appraiser, who would then calculate how much tax that person paid last year and multiply it by a yet-to-be-specified ratio, giving them a partial reimbursement. In order to qualify, a person would have to prove their home was uninhabitable for at least 2 months following a storm. State figures show storms cost Florida more than $1.5 billion last year, including nearly $730 million in individual property damage from Hurricane Matthew alone. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
Smaller restaurants in historic Jacksonville neighborhoods might soon be able to serve liquor under a bill heading to the Florida legislature. The affected neighborhoods are Murray Hill, Springfield, and San Marco. Current law restricts liquor licenses to restaurants with at least 150 seats. This law lowers that threshold to 100 seats. A similar law passed last year for restaurants in Riverside and Avondale. City Councilman Jim Love says he wants smaller restaurants to have a better chance of success.
Some of these restaurants, you know, work on a thin line, and that market that they get from selling liquor could put them into the black so they can stay open longer.
According to Love, many older buildings that house restaurants are unable to physically expand due to historic designations. Lene Volmecki is the coordinator for the Duval Legislative Delegation. She says approval by the council is only the first step.
It gets noticed in the local newspaper, and then 30 days after that, the bill can be filed. So March 2nd, I believe, it will be filed.
Because the bill is an exception to state law, it must be approved by the legislature and signed by Governor Rick Scott. It's being sponsored in the House by Jacksonville Democrat Tracy Davis. Also, Florida patients could soon have access to more information about the average cost of the prescription drugs. That's if a bill sponsored by two Jacksonville lawmakers passes. As WJCT's Ryan Bank reports, the bill unanimously cleared a first hurdle in Tallahassee.
Republican Representative Clay Yarbrough wants to expand a state drug price database started more than a decade ago. MyFloridaRx.com lists 150 of the most commonly prescribed drugs and their average out-of-pocket cost for a month's supply. The website also lists where to find the medicine. In the bill's first committee hearing, Yarbrough said he wants to grow that program.
House Bill 589 would double the number that is required, or double the number that we currently have, to be 300 on the website. And additionally, the bill codifies the current practice of monthly reporting of prescription drug pricing information.
His bill would also require pharmacies to report price changes monthly, something many are already doing voluntarily. Current law requires just quarterly reports. Yarbrough says he hopes further transparency drives drug prices down at a time when the cost of prescription medication is expected to jump nearly 19% this year. That's according to a report from the Americans for Tax Fairness. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
Up next,
we smoke our meats using local pecan wood. We use all of our own spices and rubs. Everything gets sauced on the side, and it's just an experience, man. It's like no other barbecue you've ever had.
That was the owner of the Butt Hut. Now, to find out exactly what the Butt Hut is, you're going to have to stay tuned. Because first, as diplomatic relations improve between Cuba and the U.S., more and more people are traveling to the island nation. Among them is WJCT business analyst John Burr. In this week's Business Brief, he tells news director Jessica Palumbo what he learned from his recent trip.
John, welcome back. You just got back from Cuba.
Yeah, I did. I went there for about 4 days with a group from my church. We went to Havana and Santa Clara, which is a smaller city in the center of the island. You know, there are two things that really surprised me. First, the country is wide open for American tourists right now. And second, you know, once you get out of sight of Havana and a couple of the other large cities, the country is, by Western standards, really crippled by poverty.
Okay, so you say wide open, but there are still these certain criteria you have to meet to travel to Cuba, right?
Yeah, that's still the official line. The reasons for an American's visit still have to match one of these dozen categories that they have. But the reality on the ground is very different. For instance, we got a visa based on our religious activities, but at Fort Lauderdale Airport, an official from JetBlue started raising technical issues with our visa, then offered to sell us a tourist visa on the spot for $50. We stayed with the visa we had, but the point is the airlines are selling tourist visas to Americans at the airport gate for $50. That's how open it is right now. Havana is just packed with tourists. The people in the tourist business, hotel, taxis, restaurants, most of them speak English or passable English, enough to get by. And the people are very friendly to Americans. We walked extensively through Havana, never felt unsafe the whole time.
So with this new openness with the U.S., what does this potentially mean for the Jacksonville business community?
It's interesting. Jacksonville has historic business ties to Cuba that predate that communist revolution in 1959 with shipping and trade and such. But it's interesting, there appears to be little interest among city business leaders in reestablishing those ties. Part of the reason I've heard is the feeling that Cuba is so poor, they have no money to pay for American goods. Another part of the reason, though, is also political. There continues to be a strong distaste, especially among Republican leaders, to engage with Cuba, which means engaging with the Cuban government. And that distaste carries over to a large segment of our business community, including the Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce.
So do you see that changing?
I think it will over time. It's going to be interesting to see how long Jacksonville businesses continue to hold Cuba at arm's length. Certainly some very large bets are being made on the growth of Cuban trade and tourism. We saw a huge dilapidated shipping warehouse in Old Havana, right on the waterfront, being torn down, and the Cubans are building a huge new cruise terminal there. It seems like if there's any quick fix out there for Cuba, economically speaking, it seems like tourism's it.
That's WJCT business analyst and Cuban tourist John Burr. I'm news director Jessica Palumbo.
And finally, hungry downtown workers have a new place to grab a bite after the opening of Jacksonville's first urban food park earlier this past week. Organizers say a city ordinance passed in 2014 helped make this all possible. WJCT's Ryan Banks stopped by to smell what's cooking.
Patrons are just starting to line up for a taste of the Butt Hut Smokehouse's Florida spin on barbecue. Jacob Bandert, the truck's owner, is working hard to put together everyone's orders.
We do a traditional technique. We smoke our meats using local pecan wood. We use all of our own spices and rubs. Everything gets sauced on the side, and it's just an experience, man. It's like no other barbecue you've ever had.
Bandert's is just one of four trucks serving lunch adjacent to the SunTrust building. Every weekday, a rotation of four trucks will set up at lunchtime for what's called the Court, an urban food park. It's the creation of urban planner Jack Schad.
It's an example of what they call tactical urbanism. It's using the assets that are already there in a creative way. We hope that it brings people out of their office, that it brings people together, that it provides another amenity for downtown.
Schad says it's possible because the city cut a lot of permitting red tape in 2014. That's after Councilman Reggie Brown hammered out the contentious legislation with traditional restaurants, wary of competition for downtown's limited foot traffic. Schad says depending on the success of the lunch rush, he plans to open the park on nights and weekends too. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
And that's our show. You can find all of our audio and web stories at wjctnews.org. You can also stream this podcast as well as all of our on-air content on the WJCT app, which is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. And of course, find us on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. I'm Vince Kong, and thank you for listening.